Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hi, Kathy. How are you doing?
I like to talk about this time, you know, the 70s and 80s and all the killings that happened.
Yeah.
That sounds terrible, but let's be real. A lot of sus shit.
Yep. So today we're going to talk about why there were so many serial killers between 1970 and 2000, as well as review some details about serial killers that are relevant to this information. So things you may or may not know that the culture explicates in every documentary. I am going to mention some of those as well, just because they bear witness to what we're talking about today. So not to bury the lead, but so I won't.
Don't do it.
Nope. The bigger answer to this question of why there were so many has to do with societal changes, even linguistic issues, biological, and of course, the technology changes. So that's the overarching answer to the question, is that there's a lot of different areas that affect why that was true. Much like the episode where I discussed the seven psychological stages in serial killing, I'll mention a few famous examples as we go along. And Kathy obviously will add a lot of value here too because of all of her experience. And we talk about this fairly regularly, but we want to make sure that we cover the topic and answer this question. I want to make sure I answer this question. So let me mention some of the sources where my information comes from for today's discussion. So there's this book called American Serial Killers, The Epidemic Years by Peter Vronsky. So his research is a big part of it. Harold Schechter's work as a crime historian informed it a little bit. And there's also a book called Neuroscientist, The Psychopath Inside, a neuroscientist's personal journey into the dark side of the brain. And it's written by James Fallon, and he is a self-diagnosed psychopath.
His stuff is interesting.
Oh, and as well as a Rolling Stone article from 2021 that actually discussed this very question, which was kind of me thinking, oh, that's an interesting question. Let me dig further into that. Let's start here. Vronsky's work, who is the person who wrote American Serial Killers, The Epidemic Years, he's written a bunch of books on this topic, but that's the one I was looking at. His work reveals that 80% of our known serial killers were offending between 1970 and 1999. Also, Schechter coined this period as the golden age of serial killing. So now there's a lot of research around 1950 to 2000. This book, or narrowed it down to 1970 to 1999, was 80% of that, which I think bears out why all of the serial killers we've talked about pretty much have all been in that period of time. Let me review a few serial killer pointers so that we all understand.
Thank you for setting this up for success.
Who we are talking about psychologically and biologically, etc. Over the course of Vronsky's work, he deduced basically that serial killers generally develop the personality and compulsion befitting a killer when they're young. Basically, by the time they're 14, they're fully formed, and they generally start to kill in their late 20s. Now, in his work, he's looking at statistics, right? He's looking at all the cases, crunching the data, and looking at these generalities. He also talks about what they were born with and their childhood environment affects their ability to kill. This is also why people can misconstrue serial killers' experiences. Like I talked about last week when we were talking about female psychopathy, they can misconstrue those serial killers' histories and experiences, even as a young person, as trauma, when in actuality, they enjoy and attach sexual enjoyment to what might traumatize you or me. For instance, the Golden State Killer, which we talked about recently. D'Angelo was in the Navy. He never saw combat. His father was in the Air Force. And according to family members, he witnessed his sister being raped by two soldiers when the family was stationed in Germany. Certainly, this would be traumatic for an average boy. Would it cause that boy to become a sexual predator by itself? The research doesn't bear that out. It's kind of like, probably not. But thinking about another predator Phil Hughes, by that age, he was already having violent sexual fantasies against girls and women. So this is all coming from Vronsky's work. Hughes killed at least three women in California in the 70s, and Vronsky was saying that he could see somebody like Phil, when he sees this violence being inflicted on his sister, he's not going to be traumatized. He's going to be stimulated by it. And he was kind of wondering, like, is D'Angelo the same? Like, was he stimulated instead of being traumatized? So we don't know necessarily what was in their head for that moment, but that's the consideration. So our first thought to try to answer the question is societal circumstances, which calls back to sort of D'Angelo, you know, was in the Navy, his father was in the Air Force, et cetera. So that's going to come up here. This was an interesting piece of the research, I thought. Gacy, Dahmer, Bundy, Radar, Cottingham were all born during a wartime. So many had fathers who were war vets with undiagnosed PTSD. This neuroscientist, James Fallon, agrees with Vronsky when he talks about how serial killers being the children of war. And so this is one of the things that came out of all of his research, was that this period was such a golden age of that, because these were the kids of a lot of fathers who came home from the war with undiagnosed PTSD. And you have a dominating mother, a dad with PTSD that's not being treated. You have abuse in the picture. He basically found that people with psychopathy, sociopathy, and other serious personality disorders are basically coded for aggression and violence already, low emotional empathy, low anxiety, low reactivity, etc. And those disorders can remain relatively mild if someone had a good upbringing. In fact, this author, this Fallon guy who says he's a self-diagnosed psychopath, has never been to jail. He's never committed any kind of crime like that. And yet he says he's a psychopath, but he defines that as like he had a good upbringing. And so although he may have felt like he was coded for those things, he didn't have this father with undiagnosed PTSD, dominating mother, a lot of abuse in the picture, being removed from the home is a lot of what we've seen as well. It distorts the biological picture. So you could be coded for it and not become a serial killer.
That's exactly right. And that goes back to, I know you were just saying this, but just to reiterate and put it all together, is just the idea of the right or wrong environmental factors and situation needs to be present for there to be any reason for a psychopath to even become violent.
Yeah, because not every child of a war veteran became a serial killer, but he did see this major pattern of the time frame. And so then it was like, well, why did these particular people become killers when, of course, the majority of the wartime babies were not, you know, were off living their lives just fine. And so this is what he found, is this combination of the environmental picture layered on top of the biology. Fallon talks about, you know, it's not just the early environment by itself, and it's not just the gene. It's the interaction of these two that predisposes you to these radical, aggressive, antisocial behaviors. All the people I've ever studied, this is Fallon talking, every murderer and every dictator, every one of them was either abandoned or abused between birth and 3 years old, except Pol Pot, surprisingly. He said he had a great upbringing. So for those of you who don't know who that is, Pol Pot was a Cambodian revolutionary politician and dictator who ruled Cambodia as prime minister of during the 70s. That's what I'm talking about. Like, he's literally studied, you know, he literally brought in data and information from that many people. And this is what he found. Can you imagine? Every murder and every dictator during that time period was abandoned or abused between birth and 3 years old.
It makes so much sense.
I know it makes sense to us, but like,
that's the most sensitive period, you know, and that's where we are. To not digress too much, I'll hear things in my work like, well, the child's too young to be able to tell. I'm like, this is the time where all of this starts is this is where they are sponges. This is where their nervous system is developing. This is where their environment and whether they're getting the appropriate nurturing, depending on what's happening to them in this moment. Are they abandoned in those moments? Are they mirrored in those moments? So we tend to, as a society, we tend to really underestimate. We often think that like elementary school children are the most impressionable. and they are. They're still little, right? They're developing. But we think because a child doesn't speak that this pre-verbal part of their life is really not as meaningful. But you and I both know that this is where all that injury begins.
Yeah. All the narcissistic injury happens pre-verbally.
Yep.
It's why narcissists can't really discuss being narcissists.
You'd have to put them in a time machine and send them back to that pre-verbal space.
They have to go through a lot of work, and they can. I've known narcissists who are self-proclaimed and have gone through that work to identify and then try to ratify their behavior. But it takes a ton of self-knowledge and a ton of work to get to that place because it's pre-verbal. It's a pre-verbal injury. They don't remember.
Right.
For instance, Ramirez. We've spoken about Ramirez in the past. Kathy did a whole series on that, so you can go back and check that out. But Vronsky points out that Ramirez grew up in a violent household and had a Vietnam vet cousin who suffered from PTSD who told him stories about sexually assaulting and decapitating Vietnamese women. And that same cousin killed his wife in front of Ramirez. Ramirez himself described transitioning into, quote unquote, like a different world after witnessing that. So again, a vet, undiagnosed PTSD, aggressive, angry, and exposing Ramirez to a lot of things prematurely for his age. He also pointed out that Ramirez suffered a frontal lobe injury as a 2-year-old when attempting to climb a chest of drawers. So we now know that frontal lobe injuries, like the ones that football players get, right, or any kind of contact sport, are linked to serious behavioral disturbances, including what I think they call, at least what I was reading, they call injury-induced psychopathy. So childhood frontal lobe injuries are often reported in serial killer biographies, and that is absolutely something we see over and over again. A TBI changes who you are.
Especially that frontal lobe is super
especially
important.
Especially as a kid.
Yeah. Everything's developing. And that's the part of the brain that develops last. So imagine how sensitive and vulnerable it is at that point.
Like a little soft ball.
Really?
All of that to say, there were other reasons why this period of time was very popular for serial killers. And I just want to connect this, what will seem like a simple connection, but you got to say it. In the 70s, many killers preyed on hitchhikers. Guess what happened? People stopped hitchhiking.
Right.
So then killers broke into homes like Ramirez and D'Angelo. But guess what? They didn't have to combat security systems. What do? We got started getting home security systems. In the 90s, the victim pool turned to sex workers. Because now that was the easiest, you know, there were no more hitchhikers. Breaking into homes was harder. There was technology that would prevent you from doing that. So sex workers who would like get in your car. And then technology starts to come. People start to murder online, so to speak. Craigslist.
Yeah, Craigslist killer.
Craigslist murdering massage therapists, murdering sex workers. You know, they can't pick up hitchhikers or easily pick up sex workers anymore because all the sex workers turned online, not all of them, obviously, but many of them. And so they go on Craigslist and pose as whoever and murder that way. It's important just to look at that. It's like the 70s, 80s, 90s, and even before, a little bit before, it's all 80% because the victim pool was easier to get to. The DNA stuff, the technology to catch criminals, the discussions between different precincts and our, you know, FBI and cops and everything, like now they talk to each other. They didn't used to talk to each other. So cross-state murdering was not as easy to identify. So all those societal changes that were in many ways a reaction to all the killing going on just changed where the victim pool was. So that's another reason why that period was a hotbed for a golden age of serial killing, so to speak.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This was interesting. One of the sections that they talk about is linguistics and why that was a reason. So Fallon talks about linguistics playing a part in why serial killers seem relegated to a specific time period. Now, FBI agent Robert Ressler is often credited with coining the term in the 70s, serial killer. If you talk to people, and this is a quote from Fallon, the neuroscientist that I've been talking about. If you talk to people who are in the police or in the FBI and even parts of criminology and forensics, they look at it in a taxonomic way by definitions, he says. And these definitions are not inherently for anybody in psychiatry, psychology, and he doesn't find them particularly useful. They're very artificial and it's for keeping FBI statistics. And he's saying like he doesn't find that particularly useful in his work. And so I think what he's trying to assert, at least what I understood, is that that's how all of this information kind of started out, right? The FBI got involved, they coined the term, they started looking at patterns, they started to try to profile, and that was all in FBI terms, where in criminology terms, whereas in psychology and psychiatry, which is where Dr. Fallon is coming from, that wasn't quite jiving for him. It didn't help him understand the character of it. It didn't take into consideration necessarily, at least in the beginning, trauma and what they were doing and all mm-hmm. the injuries when they were a kid and all of that. So for him, it was like, well, that's all well and good, but that's for criminology. That's not for psychology. So that was one of the setbacks we were having as far as understanding where they were coming from, is that it didn't speak in psychological terms, is what he's talking about.
Okay.
For example, Fallon says there's far more female serial killers than we may be aware of, though killers like Eileen Wuornos, which we have also done episodes on, so you could check those out, present as a rare example. Women often go under the radar because they're more often psychopaths who use sociopaths to do their dirty work. And so much like Charles Manson, you know, he got hit. He was a psychopath who used sociopaths, or some of his followers were mm-hmm. psychopaths, to execute his crimes than him doing it himself. And we find that, at least the data bears out, that women are more likely to do that than men. And so the numbers, he's talking about how the numbers are artificially low, basically.
For women.
For female serial killers.
Yeah, that makes sense.
If you count in the ones that are just manipulating others to do their dirty work, then the number goes pretty much way up to where men are. And we talked about that also in our Patreon minicast about Rose West and about some of the other couples. Mm-hmm. I thought that's also relevant for that, because we were looking at those women going, is this all just a play? Because these seem very, but it's like they're not necessarily doing the killing. They're with these men that are doing the killing. But it was always hard to sort of piece out who was driving the bus.
Well, yeah, sure. And all the statistics were, I don't think they were as, there were just assumptions made that this was all being done by men.
Yeah.
So, you know, like.
And that's another reason why it'd be artificially low, right?
Yeah. They're not tracking any of this. And they're mm-hmm. not, all the statistics are based on what was readily available and what they were looking for. And this is going to sound sort of strange, because it's not a compliment, but they weren't really paying attention to the women.
No.
And not assuming they weren't assuming that women could even be this level.
Yeah, no, the cultural aspect is very apparent. And what I found interesting about this is what he's saying is that, well, one of the big reasons for that is because they're not counting in the way a psychopath uses others. They're only counting in the ones who just strangle, mutilate, and kill people. They're not counting the ones who use a bunch of sociopaths or other psychopaths to do their dirty work. And women are more often likely to do that. So if you count in that, then you're going to have a way bigger mm-hmm. number for female serial killers. Mm-hmm. So there's this 2019 study that I forgot to mention at the beginning, but this is also a really interesting study. It's called Sex Differences in Serial Killers. And there's a bunch of authors, Harrison, Hughes, and Gott. Sex Differences in Serial Killers, it was originally published in the Evolutionary Behavioral Sciences Journal. And I wanted to mention that because it's quoted in a couple of other things that I read. And whereas I haven't read the original study, which I would like to, I did see what it bore, you know, what fruit it bore. Researchers studied 55 male serial killers and 55 female serial killers who committed their murders between 1856 and 2009 in the U.S.
All right.
The study found that men often act as, quote, hunters, seeking out and killing strangers, while women are gatherers, killing those around them for gain. As an example, they use an example, Amy Dugan, a nursing home proprietor who married and killed 5 older men and convinced 9 elderly women to put her in their wills before poisoning them in the early 1900s. So that study makes a lot of sense with what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at the hunter versus the gatherer.
We're culturally... we're wired for different things biologically. And so we're talking about that. And I think that's really interesting. And so I think it's fantastic this, because we talk a lot about female psychopathy on this show, to wind into the answer to this as to, you know, the numbers for female serial killers were artificially low. So this is this linguistic issue of like, our numbers might be low now, because we're not taking this into consideration. So here's another piece. They talk about how we have a barrage of images of white serial killers and white victims. There's only 51% of serial killers from 1970 to 2000 that were white. So whereas that profile that we get from, you know, either the FBI or the media or wherever we see it, is it's like in those 30 years... where they're saying 80% of the serial killers were killing during this time, and then 51% of them were white male. That's not like an overwhelming number for white male serial killers. Because we're talking about how the female numbers are not correct.
That's right.
And we're talking about how white serial killers and white victims is only 51%. This is their argument. This is these researchers' argument for that, is that the primary, this is the quote, the primary reason we don't hear about African-American serial killers more, especially from the 70s to the 90s, is that the issue of who their victims were. Although not always, murders in general tend to occur within the racial group of the murderer. As such, Black serial killers often target non-white victims who didn't get the same coverage in the news media due to the inherent racism of the time between 1970 and 2000.
Can I just stop for a second? I just want to make this comment, and it might be obvious, but I think it's just so crazy to me that because serial killers are so notorious and there's such a, even though this is not completely true, but the way that it's presented is serial killers... the majority of the time are these intelligent, good-looking, wealthy individuals that the notoriety in the past has really only paid attention to these white male serial killers. Yet if the crime is looked at as something that's like not a serial crime, that's looked at as just primitive and awful and there's nothing notorious about it, then we're so quick to get statistics on Black homicide. I don't know. It's just so crazy to me.
Yeah. Black victims don't get the support from our society to avenge their deaths, to get justice right. for them dying.
But neither did the perpetrators. Like, not that we want to give them, no, but no, you know no. what I mean? Like, it's like,
no, but they get away with it longer. Yeah. So this is what I'm about. Okay. Okay. So let me just say this one thing. If you look at the Atlanta, because we've talked about the Atlanta child murders before as well, a series of crimes at the end of the 70s in which nearly 30 largely black children and adults were killed. And Wayne Williams was arrested and convicted for two of the adult murders in 1982, but still maintains his innocence when it comes to the rest. The case languished for decades until 2019 when Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms ordered it reopened so that the DNA could be tested using the most technology. So what they're talking about is exactly what you're saying, Kathy, which is, okay, so if the data bears out that white people usually kill white people, other races usually kill within their own race, then if a marginalized community is the victim of a serial killer, they're not going to get the media, the law enforcement, they're not going to get as much attention as a white victim because of the inherent racism, mm-hmm. which was even worse during this period we're talking about between 1970 and 1999. And then when there are this 49% of serial killers during this time that we never fucking talk about, were people of color and killing people in their own races, mm-hmm. the serial killers who are people of color could get away with it for 30, 40, 50 years yeah. because no one was looking for their victims.
No, nobody cared about them.
Oh, unbelievable. So I just want to make...
And nobody was impressed
no.
by their
no.
craft the way they were by fucking Bundy and all these guys. Like, we... Hell, I mean, it's very different now. We try not to use names and things like that when people,
right.
the shootings, all, but at this time, like, people were enamored and impressed. You know, we were calling serial killers the Casanova killer.
I know.
Right? Like, we were worshiping them
yes.
because they were white men.
Yes.
It's disgusting.
Yes. There's a lot of things. There's all these societal changes, all these technical changes. There's all these linguistic changes, all these moving forward with cultural divide and the cultural differences. And I don't know. I feel like we're still way behind the curve on that. But I'm going to end this with a fun fact.
That one here.
You know, it's not that fun, but it's a fun fact. It was kind of off topic, but I wanted to talk about it. So this guy Vronsky, who wrote the American Serial Killers book, which was, you know, a big deal when it first came out, and I think it's still a solid read if this is the type of thing that you study. He also wrote this book called Sons of Cain, A History of Serial Killers from the Stone Age to the Present, which I find, I'm like, what? I got to read that one. Now, I haven't read it, so I just read some quotes from it. From an interview, actually. And in this book, he argues that we have always had serial killers, but we just do not have a record of them mm-hmm. because there was no formal law enforcement agencies in the form of police as we know it, nor a printing press that distributed news or accounts of serial murder in the way there was by the time Jack the Ripper came in on the scene in 1888. So we didn't have the media. We didn't have police. So he goes on to describe how during the great, this is great. You're going to love this. Mm-hmm. He goes on to describe how during the great witch hunt in Western Europe between the 15th century and the 18th century, serial killers were put on trial as werewolves. You're welcome.
Wow.
They were not furry beasts driven mad by the moon, but humans with a taste for stalking, assaulting, and killing their prey.
Wow.
So witches and werewolves.
Yes.
Were put on trial.
I understand.
So once the witch hunts ended, we have approximately 150 year period where there are no serial killers reported or werewolves as the ecclesiastical enforcement system no longer existed. Because before this 150 year period, like in the 15th, 16th century, it was the religious folks who were, you know, drawing and quartering everybody and actually just basically acted as the police, right? So
that's
then
right.
For this 150 year period after the witch trials, there's no ecclesiastical enforcement system, and serial killers were probably lynched by the local communities as there existed no quote unquote criminal police or criminal prosecutorial bureaucracy. The serial killer then reemerges in the late 1880s, Jack the Ripper, obviously, after the organization of the formal police services and judicial systems, and hence the rise of killers like Jack the Ripper, and the police were there to hunt him, and the media were there to follow his exploits. And that's why the record kind of starts there.
I see.
Yeah. Isn't that fascinating? I think that's fascinating. And by the way, serial killers are werewolves. I didn't know if you knew.
I do now. It's all starting to make sense.
I just love the history part of it, obviously.
But that makes sense. Like, you know, the record keeping stuff, because when we did the episode, oh my gosh, it was like last month, where I was talking about, there was a podcaster who I'd gotten a lot of the research from, and how she was saying that one of the original serial killers was from like an ancient Chinese blah, blah, blah. And they had documented it. I mean, it really does. I mean, how would we not have that since the beginning of time?
Right.
You know, it is wired. It's a primitive part of who we are.
Yeah. We just don't have record of the, you know, who keeps the records for these things? The media.
Yeah.
And the police. So we just don't have those records from before this particular time. Now, where he's getting, I'm looking forward to reading Vronsky's book about this stuff in longer historical times, hundreds of years ago, because it's all interconnected with, you know, witches and werewolves and the mythological way they approach things, because it was all coming from this religious perspective and this ecclesiastical wording, again, with linguistics, right? Again, linguistics is playing a huge part of what we call things and how we look at history. So I don't know. I find this shit fascinating, man.
Totally fascinating. It's right up our alley.
So I would check out all this source material, actually, by the way, if any of you are interested, from Vronsky and Fallon, et cetera. It's interesting if you're interested. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Terror Talk. I really appreciate you.
I'm really interested.
My name is Shannon.
And I'm Kathy. Sleep safe, everyone.